We all experience it, don't we? That deep yearning for rest, that feeling of longing for just a break from the pace of life. We chase the weekend, you know, that
Yeah.
finally feeling. But have you ever noticed how even those moments, the ones we really look forward to, they often feel, well, incomplete? Like there's always that little whisper, Monday is coming.
It's true. It's a feeling that kind of haunts us, doesn't it? Even like in retirement, our sources point this out. There's always something. Things break, work still needs doing somehow. We seem to be in this perpetual state of unrest. It's a reminder that something fundamental got messed up. The material we're looking at suggests sin made work itself burdensome. So even our attempts at rest end up feeling, yeah, fleeting, not quite whole.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Because that feeling, that persistent unrest, that's really the heart of our deep dive today. We're going to explore this pretty profound concept. The idea of a, well, a new Sabbath in a world that just feels so restless, so full of striving. We're mainly drawing from the Gospel of John, chapter 5, mostly, and connecting it back to foundational texts like Genesis, Jeremiah, Exodus, and Hebrews as well.
Yeah, and as we dig into these texts, what we're going to find are some, frankly, surprising ha moments. This isn't just about getting a day off, you know, or even just the weekend. We'll see how Jesus offers a radically different kind of rest, something that goes way beyond just pausing our week. It really addresses that deep, fundamental human unrest we were just talking about.
So to really get this new kind of rest, we kind of have to go back, right back to the beginning, to creation itself. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, you see God's pattern laid out pretty clearly. It's deliberate. 6 days of work, like intentional, purposeful work. And then the seventh day, rest. And it's interesting, the order is important there, isn't it? Work first, then rest.
Exactly. God built that rhythm right into how things are supposed to be. And this wasn't just, you know, stopping physical activity. It was meant to be a state of peace, that deep, holistic well-being. Shalom. But then,
Yeah.
well, then sin enters the story and that divine pattern gets seriously disrupted. Think about Eden. Adam and Eve's sin led to exile from that place of perfect shalom, that original design where work and rest weren't opposed. And the pronouncement comes down, by the sweat of your brow, you shall work.
Right. Work becomes hard.
Yeah, difficult, burdensome, a struggle. And that's why we carry this feeling, this weight. It's why even our weekends, our intended rest times, feel incomplete. That nagging Monday is coming feeling, that's a direct echo of that original disruption. It stops us from finding truly perfect rest in this world.
Okay, so we've got this universal longing, this distortion by sin. Now let's jump forward. John chapter 5. Picture Jerusalem during a feast. This should be a time of pure celebration, of rest. People reclining at tables, enjoying themselves. It's supposed to be a time of shalom. But what Jesus finds there, well, it paints a really different picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Right there in Jerusalem, near a very significant gate, the sheep gate, you know, the gate used for bringing lambs for sacrifice. It already hints at atonement. Right there was the Pool of Bethesda. Its Aramaic name means House of Mercy. Imagine this place. It had five roofed colonnades, five being a number often linked to grace in the Bible. And it had these two sections, probably for collecting rainwater, used for ritual purification before going into the temple nearby.
So a place set up for cleansing, for getting ready to approach God, but you're saying there's a twist.
A huge twist. Here's the stark contradiction. Jerusalem is the holy city, right? The temple is God's holy place. Yet immediately outside this sacred space, under these colonnades meant for grace and mercy, you find a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, paralyzed people just gathered there. Such a jarring image. A wrong picture, as our sources put it. You'd expect order, cleanliness near holiness.
Like expecting perfect gardens near a palace, maybe. Exactly. Instead, you have this concentration of suffering right on the doorstep of the temple. Our sources really emphasize this points to a deeper failure. The religious system itself, it wasn't providing the spiritual healing people needed. And the leaders, the shepherds who were supposed to care for the vulnerable, well, they were clearly neglecting them. The care just wasn't there.
And in this crowd, this multitude, there's one man. He stands out because he's been an invalid for 38 years. I mean, that's just staggering. A lifetime of suffering right there.
Yeah. And when Jesus sees him, he asks this question that seems, well, almost obvious on the surface. Do you want to be healed?
Seems like a yes or no question, right?
You'd think. But Jesus asks it, our sources suggest, to get at something deeper. This issue of misplaced trust. Where were people actually looking for healing? They were focused on rituals, places, maybe even superstition. Not the true source. The whole system had kind of become corrupted. And the leadership, well, they weren't teaching the real truth of God's word.
And the man, he doesn't even answer directly, does he?
Hmm.
He doesn't say yes. Instead, he just points out his problem, his impossibility. Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going another steps down before me. It's just this cry of complete helplessness.
He's totally stuck. The very system he's hoping in is the reason he can't get help.
Right. And this gets to that common belief back then. It's mentioned in a verse some manuscripts have, verse 4. The idea was an angel stirred the water and the first person in got healed. Now, there are huge problems with this belief, according to the sources we're looking at. It completely clashes with God's kingdom. First, it set up this awful me-first competition. Literally, you had to scramble and beat everyone else to get healed.
Which is the total opposite of the kingdom idea. The first will be last.
Exactly. And second, think about who it excluded. The very people who needed it most. The blind, the lame, the paralyzed. They could never be first. They were completely shut out by this system. And yet, despite all that, Jesus just cuts right through it. His command is so simple, so direct. Get up, take your bed, and walk. And the text says, at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Just like that. Immediate. Powerful.
Now, you might be thinking, wait a minute. Out of that whole multitude, Jesus only heals one guy. Doesn't that seem a bit unfair?
Yeah, it does raise that question.
John includes this, our sources argue, to show God's sovereignty, his grace. Remember Exodus 33.1 mean, God says, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. Healing, grace, mercy. They aren't things we earn or are owed. Jesus's purpose here wasn't just about fixing everyone's physical problems right then and there. He had a much bigger spiritual goal. The physical healing was like a sign pointing to something much deeper.
Right. And this is where the story takes a really interesting turn, isn't it? The immediate reaction from the Jewish leaders. It wasn't joy or amazement for the man. Not at all. Their problem wasn't the healing. It wasn't even Jesus telling him to get up or walk. Their whole issue, the absolute focus, was that the man was taking up his bed on the Sabbath. Think about that.
Mm.
That bed wasn't just stuff. It was his place of rest. His symbol of 38 years of being stuck.
His identity, almost.
Yeah. So picking it up on the Sabbath, that was seen as not just breaking some rule, but like actively rejecting the whole idea of Sabbath rest for that day. It was a visual nope to what they thought the Sabbath meant.
And to be fair to them, their interpretation had backing in the Old Testament law. Jeremiah 17 is really clear. Verses 19 to 27 explicitly say, do not bear a burden on the Sabbath day or bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem or do any work, but keep the Sabbath day holy.
So carrying that mat, that bed,
that was definitely seen as bearing a burden, moving your place of rest. So technically, yeah, it violated the Sabbath law as they understood it. Okay, and this leads us straight into our first major takeaway from this whole encounter. In this sinful world, this world full of unrest, God has given us a new Sabbath in the person of Jesus. See what Jesus is doing. He's fundamentally shifting the location of rest. It's not about the physical bed anymore. It's not even primarily about a specific day of the week. Rest is now found in him, in Jesus himself.
That's a huge shift.
It is. And it's probably why, when you look at the Ten Commandments, Jesus emphasizes all of them again in the New Testament except the Sabbath command. Because, as our sources powerfully put it, Jesus is the new Sabbath. He's our resting place. Think about his invitation. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Our ultimate rest isn't in a schedule or a place. It's found in relationship with him.
And the miracle itself, the healing, that was kind of the proof, wasn't it? It authenticated this new idea. Like, if Jesus just showed up and said, hey, everyone, changing the rules about the Sabbath, people might have just ignored him.
Right. Probably dismissed him completely.
But because he performs this incredible, undeniable miracle, showing his divine power and authority, the man's obedience then picking up his bed, even though it broke the Sabbath rule that gives real weight to Jesus's claim, he experienced the power. And that validated the shift Jesus was introducing. Okay, so later on, Jesus finds the man again. This time he's in the temple, which is significant in itself. Our sources suggest Jesus likely entered through that same sheep gate.
Reinforcing that identity as the sacrificial lamb.
Right.
And it's here that Jesus says something really crucial to the man. See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. Jesus is making it clear. The point of the healing wasn't just getting his legs working again. It was about holiness, spiritual restoration. The man didn't earn the healing, obviously. It was grace. But now that he had it, he had a responsibility. He had to live it out, turn from sin.
And that phrase, nothing worse may happen to you, What could possibly be worse than 38 years of being paralyzed?
Well, according to Jesus here, it's being an eternal invalid, permanently cut off from God's mercy, God's grace, which is exactly what Jesus came to provide through his ultimate sacrifice, that connection, that grace. And this leads us right into the second core insight we can draw from this. In a sinful world full of unrest, God has given us a new Sabbath to bring us back into the garden.
Back to the garden, like Eden.
Exactly. Our sources point out the temple itself was built with garden imagery, lots of carvings of plants, fruits. It was meant to evoke a sense of paradise, that place of peace and rest, God's presence. So this man who was once exiled, you know, stuck outside, unable to participate fully, he's now brought back into God's presence, back into this symbolic garden, this place of rest and peace, just like Adam and Eve were meant to be.
And this whole thing, Jesus defying the Sabbath, challenging their understanding of rest. It wasn't just a small disagreement. It escalated things dramatically.
Yeah.
The Jewish leaders weren't just annoyed now. They actually started seeking to kill him. And it wasn't just for the Sabbath breaking. It was because when he said, "My Father is working until now, and I am working."
He was basically saying, "I am equal with God."
Yeah. That was the bigger offense to them. And our sources really highlight how deliberate Jesus was.
Yeah.
Healing on the Sabbath, making the man carry the bed, and even the repetition. Mentioning taking up the bed five times in just a few verses. That number five, again, linked to grace. It was all driving home this radical new point.
Absolutely. Remember, the Sabbath day itself was the specific sign of the old covenant. Exodus 31.33 says that explicitly. But now, with Jesus bringing in the new covenant, that old sign, well, it's superseded. It's no longer the primary signifier. Think about the old system's restrictions. Only certain holy people, the priests, only one holy place, the temple, only specific holy times, the Sabbaths and feasts.
Right. Very defined.
Very defined. But under the new covenant, through Christ, all believers are called a royal priesthood. Christ dwells in our hearts, not just a building. And the Sabbath rest, it becomes a forever Sabbath, a constant state of resting in him, not just a 24-hour period.
So when Jesus says, "My Father is working until now and I am working," what does that really tell us about this forever Sabbath then?
It points directly to his ultimate work, his saving work. God's work of redemption didn't stop at creation's seventh day. It continued. And Jesus is carrying out that work. We see the culmination of his work later in John chapter 19, verse 30. On the cross, he says,
"It is finished."
Exactly. It is finished. His work of atonement is done, complete. And then Hebrews 12.2 tells us he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Sitting down signifies completed work, ultimate rest. He isn't still striving. The decisive work is done. And the book of Hebrews makes this connection so explicitly. It ties together Sabbath rest, faith in Christ, and God's original rest from creation. It stresses that entering this rest, God's true rest, isn't about following rules or our own efforts. Our works are described as filthy rags, right? Totally inadequate.
Right.
Entry comes by faith in him, through union with Christ. Hebrews points out that it was disobedience and unbelief that kept the Israelites out of the promised land to rest. And it urges us now to strive to enter that rest, the rest found in faith in Jesus. Which brings us neatly to our third and final core insight for today. In a sinful world full of unrest, God has given us a new Sabbath of eternal rest through the finished work of Christ.
Wow. Okay, so let's try and pull this together for you listening. What does this all really mean? We've seen first that Jesus himself is a new Sabbath. He's our place of rest, not just a day. Second, this new Sabbath rest he offers actually brings us back into God's presence, back to the garden, restoring that relationship. And third, ultimately, he gives us this deep eternal rest that comes entirely through his finished work. Nothing we add.
That's it, exactly. So the provocative thought, maybe, to leave you mulling over is this. What does it truly mean for you in your own life right now to pick up your bed? What false rests, what burdens, maybe, have you been relying on or carrying for far too long? What would it look like to let go of those and fully enter into the true rest that Jesus offers? How might embracing this new Sabbath through faith actually transform your daily grind, your work, your responsibilities, your experience of genuine spiritual peace? What does it mean for you today to strive to enter that rest?